Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and happy 4th of July weekend to you. This year, instead of celebrating the season with loud fireworks and blaring patriotic music, we're going to salute our nation's independence and the freedoms that we all enjoy by curling up with a good book. Today, we've got not one, not two, but five outstanding author options for you. Bethany Chafin will kick things off with, appropriately enough, the Freedom Writer's Diary author, Aaron Gruhl. Then I'll plumb the poet's perspective with family physician turned poet, Bill Griffin, award-winning local poet and educator, Terry Kirby Erickson, and University of Nebraska Chancellor's Professor of English, Kwame Dawes. Bethany wraps up with author Ken Ilgunas, his Walden on Wheels, a memoir about student debt, adventure, and freedom. There's that word again, provides the bookend to our wonderful little poetry sandwich picnic. What better way to spend your Triad Arts July 4th weekend? Next, after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this July 4th, your Triad Arts Weekend team is kicking back with a good book. We'll have some outstanding poetry, too. Associate producer Bethany Chafin starts us off on our Independence Day celebration with a nod to Freedom Writers, mentor, educator, and New York Times bestselling author Aaron Gruhl. Does that name sound familiar? Well, Aaron's the educator and mentor behind the group known as the Freedom Writers. The personal stories, classroom adventures, and educational triumphs of Aaron and her students are recorded in their moving collaboration and New York Times bestseller, The Freedom Writers' Diary, how a teacher and 150 teens used writing to change themselves and the world around them. And their story was made into a feature film back in 2007, starring Hilary Swank as Gruhl. In 2013, Aaron spoke at Salem College in the Haynes Auditorium in Winston-Salem. Prior to her arrival, Bethany Chafin spoke to Aaron by phone from her Freedom Writers Foundation office in Long Beach, California.
Tell me a little bit about how the journaling process began in your classroom and what was the reaction of your students. I mean, ultimately, we know that they embraced it, but how did that first day when you handed out those journals, what happened?
Ironically, in the feature film, we were very blessed to have our story not only get published and become the number one book in America for a period of time, but we were also incredibly humbled that they made it into a feature film starring Hilary Swank. So in the feature film, we actually really show that process, that it's not easy, of writing a story. And there's a young girl who, in the feature film, we named Ava. In reality, her name is Maria, and she had never read a book from cover to cover. She had failed nearly every class she'd ever been in. She hated reading. She hated writing. She hated me. And her first journal assignment, this is what she wrote. She wrote, "I hate Aaron Gruhl, and if I wasn't on probation, I would probably shank her." And when I read that diary entry, I was in horror and bewildered. I didn't even know what shanking was at that point. I didn't have all those urban words in my lexicon or in my dictionary. The power of writing negative, it had always been perceived as, you know, I don't speak the right words. I don't have the right spelling. I'm going to have a teacher take out their red pen and tell me all the things that I have done wrong. So it really was more of a deficit model. And what I needed to teach my students was that writing is liberating and writing is powerful and writing can be very cathartic if you write about things that matter. And so we had to look at how can we take stories that you've experienced in real time that have become these movies in your mind, put them on paper. The right spelling will come, the right punctuation will come, the right grammar will come, but the story is there. So how do we get it out of you and onto a piece of paper? And that was really the exciting part of our journey, is learning how to write powerfully and with purpose and with persuasion and no judgment. And once my students felt safe, it was very, very liberating. And so ironically, this young girl, Maria, who we named Ava in the film, went from writing, "I hate Aaron Gruhl, and if I wasn't on probation, I would probably shank her," to writing a best-selling book. And that, to me, is the greatest tribute to teaching and to writing and to individuality.
I am curious to know a bit about your interaction with the art of writing, too. And is it something that you've always sort of carried with you? Have you been a writer since you were young, or were you sort of learning along with your students the power of putting pen to paper?
That's a great question. I was an avid journaler my whole life. I have boxes and boxes and boxes of journals that I've been keeping my entire life. And so I always tried to mirror my love of writing for my students. And I believe that writing is a process. I believe that writing is this great journey you take with yourself, and it needs to be polished and perfected and draft after draft. So I've always modeled it for my students. I think the irony and the ironic twist is, once the Freedom Writer's Diary was published, and I thought my role in that publication was really helping my students tell their story and really being the narrator. I was really just kind of behind the scenes, nudging them and encouraging them and being a cheerleader of sorts. Before the feature film came out, the publishing house that published the Freedom Writer's Diary came to me and said, okay, now we want you to tell your story. And I was petrified. I thought, I am such a hypocrite. Here I've encouraged my students to, you know, pick up a pen and tell their story. Do I have something to say? Does anybody care what I have gone through? And it was the most daunting, terrifying task to sit down and write my own memoir. And through that process, I went from being this teacher to being a student and asking my own students to help me edit and to give me feedback and to set up my outline and to write draft after draft. And so it was an incredible role reversal for me. And so for the latter books that we've written subsequent books. Every time we begin the process, it is a collaboration. And so every time I get to play these multiple roles of author and editor, teacher and student, and storyteller, but also someone who listens to stories. And so I think that's been the really exciting part of our literary journey that we've shared with the world, is we want the people who read our books to then be encouraged to write their own.
I studied English, and so I'm going to ask perhaps a question for out of my own curiosity. How do they approach kind of taking a second look at their entries and maybe editing them and, you know, peer editing and things like that? Was there a different process going on at that stage?
You know, that's a great question. I think for the power of our story, what we tried to do, I had 150 students. So a lot of people who've seen the feature film, they think I just had one class and one group of unwieldy, unteachable students. But I actually had 150 in total. And that's the beauty of the Freedom Writer's Diary, is we collectively tell that story of the 150. In that group of 150 students, I realized very early on, based on some of the activities I'd done, whether it was the line game or Toast for Change, that my students had really difficult things to write about. Loss, losing their innocence, murder, mayhem, being stripped of their innocence, emotionally, physically, sexually. And so what I wanted my students to do was to feel that they could write these things down, purge themselves. But when you are a teacher, you are actually a mandated reporter. So with that role of being a mandated reporter comes a really daunting task. I would be filling out Child Protective Services forms nearly daily if I knew everyone's story. So we actually created a cultural norm in my classroom where I asked my students to come up with a code of conduct. And how do we want to approach the writing process? How do we want to share the writing process? And how do we want to work together and edit the writing process? So we came up with all of these rules that were self-generated by the students. They wanted to be anonymous. They wanted to have a number rather than a name. We wanted to type our stories in a uniform fashion, that it was Times New Roman, 12-point font, double-spaced, so no one could tell each other's writing style. And a lot of students have very discernible handwriting, so they wanted it to be incredibly anonymous. They couldn't sensationalize. And it was almost like that Las Vegas commercial where people say, what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. Well, it was this, whatever happens in room 203 stays in room 203. We have to honor and respect the storytellers. And so what happened really early on is we wanted to establish trust, collegiality, support, and in addition to knowing that these unbelievably painful stories were probably going to resonate, we had a counselor come into our classroom after school every day, because we knew that these stories were going to come out and these stories were going to be painful. And even though they were anonymous, even though the people who were potentially reading these stories did not write that particular story, we knew those stories would identify with others. And so almost daily, if a story was read, God forbid, about molestation or a story about parental abuse, almost every day, thematically, we would have somebody come in and put together a counseling session for anyone that was highly affected by that story, either having written it or read it. And it was amazing. I can't tell you the growth and the healing that would start taking place almost on a daily basis, because these stories sparked memories and these stories opened wounds. And most importantly, these stories allowed people to become whole again.
I want to follow your writers and talk about the amazing fact that all 150 graduated. And is that correct?
They did. And that's the amazing thing. I think by allowing my room to be very self-centered, I am a big believer that teachers should not teach to a test. Unfortunately, there's a lot of unfunded political mandates that have been imposed upon teachers and have really taken some of that spark and some of that passion out of my profession. And those unfunded mandates came from people who were not teachers, were not educators, who were not passionate about critical thinking. And so, unfortunately, in our country, we're really fighting that. Allow a teacher to allow a kid to stand on a desk and say, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," like they did in that movie. So for me, it was really important to allow my students to have almost this Socratic approach, to be the teacher, to teach one, to teach another, to establish those cultural norms in our classroom. And I think what happened very early on is that we believed, all 150 of us, that we're in this together, that we are going against enormous odds in a district where kids drop out, in a city where 126 kids were murdered in 1 year, in a society that has stereotyped and written off kids who are poor and of color. So let's beat those odds. And to beat those odds, we have to come together collectively and work as a family and work as a unit and work as a team. And that's really what we did very early on. We decided that all 150 of us were going to stay together and we were going to graduate and we were going to defy those stereotypes. And they did. And they did go to college. And they now are civil rights activists changing the world through education. And challenging those unfunded mandates and challenging those politicians who say teachers need to teach to a test, because my kids say no. Teachers need to teach to kids. There is no one-size-fits-all. There is no model that will reach every single kid, because kids are different. And I think that's really the exciting thing about where we are now, is we have started a foundation called the Freedom Writers Foundation. And my original students, the original Freedom Writers, now teach teachers how to really engage and enlighten and empower teachers across the world, how to be better teachers, how to be more effective, and how to inspire their students.
That's wonderful. If you were to give a piece of advice to a first-year teacher versus a teacher who has been teaching in the classroom for, say, 20 or 30 years, would that advice be the same, or would it be different?
I believe that for teaching, when it really works, it is a calling, whether it's in that one-room schoolhouse, whether it's in a living room homeschooled, whether it's in an enormous urban school, whether it's in a university. For good, passionate teachers, it's a calling. It's bigger than themselves. It's bigger than their classroom and their surrounding. And when teachers truly follow that calling, follow that inner voice, education comes to life, and it's contagious. And I want teachers to be confident enough that they're doing the right thing. And I'm troubled by the wave in our country that has tried to privatize our public schools. I'm troubled by politicians who vilify and victimize teachers. I'm troubled by pie charts and graphs that try to vilify the students themselves based on the color of their skin and the income that their parents bring in. And so what's happened is education tragically has become really politicized and very polarizing. And I just want teachers to be confident they chose the right profession and they're doing the right thing, and that if they follow their heart, kids are going to follow them. And so I really do a lot of teaching to teachers in college classrooms across the United States, getting them excited about following their passion, following their goals, doing big things. And so I hope that I can inspire a lot of teachers to be confident that they chose the right profession at the right time and in the right place.
educator, mentor, and New York Times bestselling author Erin Gruhl. She spoke with Bethany Chafin by phone from the Freedom Writers Foundation office in Long Beach, California. You'll find links to more information about Erin and the work she and her students continue to do at Freedom Writers at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and our 4th of July tribute to the written word will continue with poetry when we get back from this short break. Kwame Dawes, Terry Kirby Erickson, and Bill Griffin are poised with pen in hand next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. I'm David Ford, and it's a special Triad Arts 4th of July weekend. Bethany Chafin will be back on the second half of the show with her interview of author Ken Ilgunas. He'll share a behind-the-scenes peek at his book Walden on Wheels, a memoir about student debt, adventure, and freedom. But before that, it's time for a poetry break with Ghanaian-born Jamaican poet Kwame Dawes. He's the award-winning author of 16 books of poetry, numerous works of fiction, nonfiction, criticism, and drama. The Chancellor's Professor of English at the University of Nebraska also teaches in the Pacific MFA Writing Program. Kwame's work has been performed at the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem. Hope it's been a happy July 4th weekend for you so far. We're sort of taking a laid-back approach to the holiday this year on Triad Arts Weekend with a nod to one of life's simple, quiet pleasures, curling up with a good book. No fireworks, no marching bands, just this.
How coolly it has broken you, trying to mask the knowing wit behind your eyes. Every smile brilliant against your gleaming black skin is defiance. You stammer, push out words, tell your story, slap your knees to show where your stroke-frozen body would crawl across the concrete to reach the yard with the gawking onlookers. You laugh. Man must live. Man must live. How casually broken. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what does it feel like when someone, a previous stranger, confides in you so much on such a personal level?
Wow, that's, it feels in one moment like a burden, and then it feels so liberating because in a sense, they're trusting you with their stories and their narratives and their experience. But you also know that it is a moment. And it's like getting a gift. Somebody gives you a gift, they're not giving you their whole life. They're giving you something that you make with it, what you can make with it. You honor that gift. And this support group of people allowed me to come and sit with them and just listen to them talk and answer my questions and let me laugh, and they ask questions and so on. And this is a very closed support group that has been meeting and are helping each other, and they're honest and they're funny and they're outrageous and all of these things. But they let me sit with them. And that was the great drama, the great opening for me. And Nicole's body, you can see, is just completely sort of beaten up by the strokes he's had and by the damage of this disease. But the brilliant kind of smile on his face, and he, you would listen as he struggled to say the words. And then he said, man must live, Vaya, man must live. God, what a beautiful person. What a beautiful moment. And then all day and all night, it stays with you. And for weeks, it stays with you. And then you write the poem to recapture the moment. I remember we did a performance with this in Jamaica. Nicole was in the audience, and you know, he came to me afterwards and he laughed and he said, ah, real good, man, very nice. And I tell you, that means so much.
In your travels, what you've come to see in terms of people dealing differently with AIDS in Jamaica that you could speak to?
You know, the Jamaica is a very peculiar place, and it's you know there's a recent report that came out. We're number three in the world as the happiest people in the world, number three. And Jamaicans are just amused by it because anybody gets angry, they say, hey, remember, we're number three, don't mess it up, you know. So we're looking to be number one. Well, the absurdity of this statement is that we are also the angriest people in the world. And they didn't do that stat, but it's the same thing. So those two sort of contradictory seeming things, those volatile dynamics, are part of the peculiar resilience and kind of toughness of the Jamaican people. And it is a phenomena. There's a combination of arrogance, a kind of aggression, and yet a kind of energy for life and a kind of joy for life and so on. And I think it feeds into how we deal with something like HIV. So in a positive way, it allows for people to survive through it. The negative side of it is that our capacity to be impatient and completely intolerant of difference, of the quality of homophobia, the ability to say to somebody that it's your fault that you're this way and so on, remains also high up there as well. So there are these elements that both allow survival and success and a way to live and love with the disease, and yet the same sort of qualities make it so rough for people to just get by day by day in the society, which is not a wealthy society. I mean, there's poverty in Jamaica, but it's also a place in which that struggle to make it through is almost a theme of the culture and the society, of the music and of the art and so on. I know my faith
is strong, but do Chancellor is Professor of English at the University of Nebraska, poet and author Kwame Dawes. His work has been performed at the Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem, and you'll find links to Kwame's 2013 book of poetry on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Try at Arts Weekend. The book is Duppy Conqueror, New and Selected Poems. I'm David Ford, and there's more great poetry on the way, beginning with international award-winning poet Terry Kirby Erickson. Her fourth collection of poetry is A Lake of Light and Clouds, which received high praise from New York Times bestselling author Jill Connor Brown, who wrote that Terry, quote, makes us see everyday things with new eyes and gratitude that beauty is not the exception, but the rule of life.
This particular poem is called Loretta Ray. My mother, lipstick red, barefoot, toenails painted the palest shade of pink, stretched out her dancer's legs and rubbed suntan lotion into a face that should have been magnified on a movie screen, the kind that bowled men over even with curlers in her hair and children dangling from both hands wherever she went. They never saw the greasy chaise lounge behind our house, where the sun whispered sonnets in her ears and darkened her skin with hot kisses while the radio played Blue Velvet. And the greengrocer and the mailman and the gas station attendants and the jean-clad teenage boys loitering downtown on Saturday afternoons, who caught glimpses of Loretta Ray every now and then, if they were lucky, would have dropped dead with desire if they'd seen her sunning herself in our backyard, wearing nothing but a two-piece bathing suit and a lazy, sun-drenched grin. The best years of her life almost, but not quite, passed.
Loretta Ray by Terry Kirby Erickson. That from her new book of poetry, A Lake of Light and Clouds. I love that line. They never saw the greasy chaise lounge behind her house where the sun whispered sonnets in her ears and darkened her skin with hot kisses while the radio played Blue Velvet. Such a wonderful image. And not only does it take me to dreamland, it kind of shifts gears. It slows the pace down, too. Do you think much about rhythm or tempo in your poetry at all or no?
I do. And after I write poems, I usually read them aloud. I do a lot of pacing and reading because I want to know how it sounds. I don't want there to be anything in the poem that people trip over so that they are out of the moment of the narrative. So I want to be sure that it's smooth and that I'm telling whatever story that I need to tell in a way that is musical and rhythmic.
I'm glad you said musical, because that line really hit me and just the sounds of the word, the syllables and the vowels as they pair up in her ears and darken her skin with hot kisses. It just rolls off the tongue so nicely, and it does sound like a musical line.
My mother was always a gorgeous woman. She was homecoming queen in her high school. She was a majorette. She was a model, a ballet dancer, really very beautiful. And she still is. You know, there are two parts of her life. There's this part, and then there's the moment in 1980 when my brother died. And so I kind of look at my mother's life as divided, just like mine is divided. And there was the time before that, and then the time after that. So any time that I write poetry about my mother, there's a certain poignancy to that.
I want to treat listeners to another of your poems, Terry, and this one, we're going to shift gears now because this is a very serious subject matter, Leroy and Viola.
Come Saturday morning, poor black men gathered on street corners, waiting for white men in Cadillacs to drive by slow, shouting, "Hey, boy," from their rolled-down windows, "Get in," which meant there was a job digging ditches or other back-breaking work for less money than it cost to feed the family dog. Nights were harder, what with hooded gangs of racists wrapped in bedsheets roaming the countryside, and woe to anybody who wasn't white once those half-drunk, hate-mongering mobs with their burning crosses and links of rope arrived on the scene. So in 1965, when married mother of five Viola Gregg Liuzzo volunteered to drive 19-year-old Leroy Moton back to Selma, both fresh from a freedom march in Montgomery, Alabama, the sight of a white woman with a black man in the front seat of a vehicle sporting Michigan plates didn't sit well with Klansmen who were, as usual, wild as pent-up ponies in a barn blaze. So they chased the pair down and fired two bullets into Liuzzo's brain, laughing like loons when the car careened into a ditch. Covered in blood, Moton played dead, surviving the shots, the crash, and the killer's swift perusal of the wreckage. But Viola Liuzzo is gone, except in memory, where the same reel runs over and over in Leroy Moton's mind. A pretty woman's profile, pale as milk against the purpling sky, and his hand, dark as rivers on the radio dial. Strangers joined forever by history, seconds before the slaughter.
Really powerful stuff, Terry. And before we get into the just kind of the poem as a whole, the line again, talking about sounds and combinations of words, is, and what a great image. Wild as pent-up ponies in a barn blaze. Great, great sounds, great image.
You know, again, it's with that rhythm and the music and the sound of it.
Well, describe what it took to get here, pale as milk against the purpling sky and his hand dark as rivers on the radio dial. What did it take to get there? And just if you could describe the satisfaction of arriving at a powerful, we'll call it a metaphor like that.
Well, I worked very hard on this poem because it's a true story and it's an important story to tell. And I wanted to be clear and succinct and at the same time give readers a visual so that this was a real thing because, you know, I lived in that era of segregation and I was born in 1958. You know, I was a child in the 60s, but, you know, we saw little things here and there. And the part that I wrote about the cars driving by slow, looking for young black men to work, my grandfather used to do that, you know, not in a ugly or mean way. It's just how it was done. On Saturday, you would go drive downtown, and there were men on the street corner waiting and looking for work. And that's how it was done. And I never forgot that after someone told me. I can't remember. It may have been my dad. And so I wanted to use that.
Then you arrive at that specific turn of phrase and getting back into kind of the process of writing poetry. Mm-hmm. Just to give us a hint of the effort that it took to arrive at that particular group of, that one just struck me, much like the Blue Velvet reference did in your mother's poem, the color of the hand, the mm-hmm. the pale as milk hue to her skin. How did the process work?
Well, I was always moving toward that moment. That was a central image in my mind when I began the poem. So when I finally got there, trying to find the words so that people could see that in their mind's eye, the white skin of this woman and the black skin of the man, you know, to know that there were people around who thought that it was wrong and sinful and an abomination for them to even be in the same vehicle, when in fact, by this very act, these terrible murderers nailed these two people together for all eternity.
What great irony, horrific irony, but when you look at it through that lens, that's exactly what they did.
That's exactly what they did, because all this was a ride. She was just giving this young man a ride back from the march, as she had done for many people. So they created a couple out of them, in a sense, which is what they were railing against in the first place.
Poet Terry Kirby Erickson. Her fourth collection of poetry is A Lake of Light and Clouds. Terry's also the author of In the Palms of Angels, winner of 3 international awards. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Bethany Chafin is back with a look at Walden on Wheels, a memoir about student debt, adventure, and freedom, just about 10 minutes from now. But first, more poetry. Bill Griffin is a family doctor and geriatrician living and working in rural North Carolina. Bill's poems have appeared in many regional and national journals, including Southern Poetry Review, Tar River Poetry, Poem, North Carolina Literary Review, and Pembroke Magazine. In 2009, he received the North Carolina Poetry Society's Poet Laureate Award.
All the times I've visited the zoo, you know, I've been struck by how it not only gives you a sense of the exotic, but also brings you right here home to the Piedmont, you know, because of the setting and because the displays bring the, you know, wild animals close to you. I had a close encounter of the herpetologic kind yesterday evening. I was coming back from a program, and right outside the Sonora Desert exhibit, they have a wonderful rock garden, and this black and white streaked lizard jumped up on a rock, and I thought, I've never seen one of those before. He looks like he escaped from the Sonora Desert, and we were actually just looking him up online, and he actually is a southeastern fence lizard, so he's native, but he sure looked like he belonged in that rock garden.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, your background is in medicine, family physician, and geriatrician in rural North Carolina, talking the Elkin area. Talk about that entree for you into then the world of poetry.
I had some very inspiring teachers in high school and college, and so I kept up with reading over the years, but never really did much writing until about, about 15 years ago. I took a workshop on reading contemporary poetry, and among the poets we read was A.R. Ammons, and I read the poem Hymn, which he uses a lot of scientific language to bring us not only close into the tiniest aspects of nature and creation, but also into the farthest reaches. And I thought, oh my gosh, science and poetry, they belong together.
You mentioned A.R. Ammons, and I can't think of a better kind of bridge between the world of science and poetry. Could you read a stanza or two from him?
He says, I know if I find you, I must go on out over the sea marshes and the brant and bay, over the canyons, crater lakes. And he keeps taking it out in the spiraling circles, you know, out into the atmosphere, out into space. And at the end he says, and I know if I find you, I will have to stay here with the separate leaves. So the sense I get from that is that to really discover the meaning and within ourselves, as well as the meaning of our place within our neighborhood, our habitat, our environment. It's not as if nature is out there and then where we live is something else. It's all part of one earth. Environmentalist from Africa, Baba Diom, said, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We love only what we understand. We will understand only what we are taught. So the teaching aspect of us learning, you know, about the creatures and about the places they come from might inspire us to care for them to the point where we will conserve them. And by doing that, then we preserve ourselves.
Talk about how your art does bring about some innovative ways to communicate that message.
I think poetry can teach with a metaphor or with some really vivid image and slips right through the bars of your logical thinking and teach directly to your heart.
Well, you're no stranger to this world of bringing nature to the fore through poetry, and I'm referencing here the 2008 collaboration with your wife, Linda French Griffin, to create this book, Snake Den Ridge. That's out on March Street Press. I'm looking at this list of characters that you've sketched out here: squirrels, crayfish, salamanders. Could you pick one of those from the book and maybe treat us to one of those poems?
I like to read you one of my favorites, Salamander. You know, in the Smokies, each watershed has its own distinct salamander species. So each one of these poems, the creature is actually speaking directly to the reader in first person. So this is Salamander. This is my gift to change. From Inadu Creek, I leave behind my frilly gills and climb the spire of blue-eyed grass. Having become a creature of air, bathing myself in dew, am I not still a creature of water? I invite you to discover in each of my family our variations, discern that every runnel, every spring, every palm-sized cup of moisture holds its lithe expectation, for this is my gift to you, to notice changes. I will let you lightly touch the welcome of my smoothness while I drink a little warmth from your hand. Now count the dapples down my length. Measure the blush of my cheek. Then find, when you descend the eastern face of Snake Den Ridge, those subtle alterations my cousins are accumulating until finally they acquire a new name. And when you have returned me to my bed of blue bead lily, then touch a smooth place within yourself and carry with you into the world your own changes.
Well, that's really nice, Bill, on so many levels. I love the image there of climbing the spires of the blue-eyed grass and then petting the smoothness of the skin, sharing that with the warmth of the hand, and then it comes back at the end to really forge that collaboration.
Well, I would hope that, you know, each creature in speaking something from within itself kind of touches the reader to find something within themselves that's maybe new or different or something they hadn't been aware of. And all the poems in the book also have a little backstory of an encounter behind them. The salamander we ran across as we were hiking the trail up to Clingman's Dome, and he had climbed up a spire of grass, and there he was with his red cheek. It was Jordan's red-cheeked salamander.
Great.
Which only exists in the Smokies.
...2009 North Carolina Poetry Society Poet Laureate Award winner Bill Griffin. His poetry chapbook is Little Mouse, out on Main Street Rag. The collection of 32 poems, each poem 20 lines long, speaks to the many different struggles and epiphanies we all share as members of the human family. And you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Time for a short break, and then we're back with associate producer Bethany Chafin in a trip to Walden on Wheels with author Ken Ilgunis, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's all about the written word today, and we continue with young author Ken Ilgunis. Ken was first published back in 2009. His article appeared on the news site Salon.com and was titled, I Live in a Van Down by Duke University. At the time, Ken was getting his master's in liberal studies at the university and striving to stay out of debt. The article broke the silence on one of his methods for remaining debt-free, secretly living in his Ford Econoline van. Ken chronicles his experience in his book titled Walden on Wheels, On the Open Road from Debt to Freedom. His work is relevant, honest, and inspiring, and while it addresses his adventures in van dwelling, it tells other important stories as well. Ken sat down with associate producer Bethany Chafin, and she began by asking him to describe the three sections of Walden on Wheels.
You mentioned a quote, I think it's St. Francis of Assisi. If you could repeat that, because I think it sort of summarizes your book really well and summarizes the categories that you've laid out.
I can paraphrase it for
That's
sure.
Fine.
So a laborer is someone who works with his hands. A craftsman is someone who works with their hands and their head. And an artist is someone who works with their hands, their head, and their soul. So I guess that's also kind of an arc of my story. I begin as this menial laborer paying off my debt. You know, I'm a cart pusher, I'm a tour guide, I'm a cook. These are just really repetitive menial labor jobs. And, you know, I begin to crave something more. And my desire to go to grad school stems with this desire. And, you know, I want to start working with my soul. And it's funny, like I go to Duke for no clear reason other than just to become a better, smarter person. But what I learned over time is, you know, I'm going there to become a writer. And I was able to use that experience and that education to write this book. So it's kind of this weird sort of Earl Burroughs snake eating itself in which, you know, I write the book to get a sense of meaning and purpose.
So what did your writing process look like? I know you mentioned having bought a journal during your time at Duke. Did you write daily? Did you sort of sit back after all of this, after those 4 or 5 years, and kind of start from scratch?
Definitely not from scratch. So this is sort of unusual, but me and my best friend, we would trade emails on an almost daily basis. And if we were going through a hard time, sometimes it was 2 or 3 times a day. And this was just us trying to understand ourselves, our world, our problems. So going all the way back to when I was a senior in high school, I have this huge archive of emails detailing my thoughts over the years. And not only did this help me become a better writer, it's the only thing that helped me become a better writer, but, you know, I could draw from these thoughts and bring them into the book and give it an unusual degree of authenticity. Later on, I'd get a blog when I started to go to Duke, and it was the same sort of thing. You know, I had all my thoughts and what was happening to me then. I was able to bring the book to life because I had just these rich details about what sort of tree I was parked under and the conversations I was having and the courses I was taking. So a lot of the book was sort of already written, but I did spend another year and a half working on it, kind of enriching those things, using the luxury of hindsight to, I don't know, just make it richer.
You had to keep your van dwelling a secret for a while at Duke. And you talk about some of the loneliness that came with that. And now I think about what was once a secret, now it's published for everyone to read about in all its detail. And I wonder if that's sort of a strange juxtaposition.
I mean, it's strange, but it doesn't affect me much at all. It's funny, like I have a blog, I have a book, I'm on the radio right now, you know, I've been on TV, and you get the impression that I'm this terribly extroverted person, but it's actually the exact opposite. You know, I spend almost all of my time alone and in silence, and that's kind of how I like it. I like reading and writing and gardening and going on jogs and hikes and that sort of thing. You know, it's not a big deal when I share my life with the world at large because there's no consequences of it for me. Like, I don't, like, walk down the street and people notice me. I don't walk down the street. So it's just not a big deal. You know, it's just like I'm almost emailing Josh. It's just something for him to read. And I just kind of feel disconnected from my audience, which is nice in a way because I'm able to maintain that solitude and that sense of privacy.
Comes the morning when I can feel that there's nothing left to be.
So outside in our parking lot right now is the very van that you write about.
So I still have it, and you know, I probably should get a different vehicle because the gas mileage on that thing is awful, but they're for sure is a lot of sentimental value with that van. And it's hard to think of my life without it. We've been through a lot together.
Tell us a little bit about the van.
So it's a 1994 Ford Econoline. It's got this really vulgar fade. The top is burgundy and it kind of turns into black on the bottom of it. It's got lots of dents and chip paint. Some of the tint on the windows is peeling off. It's not the prettiest thing, but it's been trusty. I've probably only put like 11,000 miles on it over the past four and a half years, but it runs really well. So it's my Walden on wheels. It's my little cabin, but a van. But it's also just the sense that, you know, it's not just a van, but you can carry this simple lifestyle with you wherever you go.
So obviously, in the book, at times you know that you're experiencing things that will be great stories. Was it obvious to you that you wanted to write these things down someday? And was it understood that maybe it would become a book even?
Well, when I went to Duke to live in the van, it was primarily just to get a graduate education. I think I recognized deep down that this could be like a story someday. So that was always in the back of my mind. And I always wanted to be a writer. So a year goes by and I'm in a travel writing course and I write about living in my van. It's kind of like a big coming out moment because I have to read my story aloud to fellow classmates. And they liked the story. My professor loved the story. And she said, you know, Ken, you should think about publishing this. And, you know, I thought, do I really want to, you know, expose myself to the country at large and, you know, tell them I'm secretly living in a van at Duke? I said, you know what, why not? I'm sick of keeping a secret. I have this great story. We were in the midst of the Great Recession and people were buying homes they couldn't afford. So I thought, you know, a story about frugality and living simple, it would be pretty timely. So she had a connection at salon.com. I wrote the story for them. And before it was even published, before it even showed up on their website, I got an email from a literary agent in New York City saying, why don't you think about turning this into a book? So, you know, before I even published my first ever national article, I'm getting propositioned by an agent to turn it into a book. So my life is just, you know, I'm thrilled upside down, you know.
It's not how it works for most writers. I hope you know
that. I think it's probably a little more of
That's
a
great,
difficult slog. At first, I think, is living in a van even that exciting? I shower at the gym, I cook a meal in my van, I hang out in the library, I go to sleep in the van. Except for a few moments of drama, there's really nothing too extraordinary about living in a van. It's really just living like in a mini dorm room. But I thought about that agent's proposal more and more, and I thought, you know what? You know, if I tie in my past, if I tie in paying off my debt, tie in my motivations to living in a van and kind of structure it as a travel memoir, as, you know, adventure travel, then there might be something worthwhile here. But I'm still a student. I'd only been in school for a year, and I still had another year and a half to go. And I almost thought about dropping out to write this book, but there just seemed something kind of wrong about that. And my instinct said, no, you're a student, stay in school, worry about the book later. And that's what I did. However, I always had the book in the back of my mind. So I took courses that would kind of help me prepare for that. For instance, I took an independent study and I called the course Student Debt and the Self. And I just kind of looked at debt from a philosophical angle and tried to understand what debt does to the human soul. And I also took two writing courses over the course of that year. For my final project in my last semester, I wrote the book in just one semester. And that would eventually become the real book once I edited it 7,500, 200 times or so. Over the course of this year and a half, I'm kind of making some sacrifices. That first summer, instead of going back to my Park Service job up in Alaska, where, you know, I'd make 12, 13 grand over the course of the summer, I decided, no, I'm going to work on a book proposal that summer and work on an independent study. So that was the first big sacrifice. So that didn't leave me with much money for the next year at Duke. So my final semester, I'm writing the final project. I'm writing the book and I'm running out of money. My whole goal was to graduate debt-free. And if it wasn't for doing 8 MRI studies in which I had my brain scanned in the last week, I might have gone into debt. So I ended up graduating with about $1,000. And, you know, I begin to second guess whether I want to write the book or not because, you know, I'm broke. I'm 27, 28 at this point. You know, should I kind of get serious and get a real job? And, you know, I'm kind of just battling with these thoughts. And I decide, you know what, I'm just going to go all out. I'm going to write this book. So I move up to Coldfoot, Alaska, where I talked with the previous boss and he hooks me up with a writer in residency. I promised to work one day a week. He'll give me free room and board. You know, I was just really excited. I was writing my book. I was a writer in residence and I wrote my first chapter for the book. I had it edited and I sent it to that literary agent who I'd kept in touch with over the past year. And he stopped returning my emails and calls after I sent him that first chapter because it was raw. It was raw for sure. And he probably thought, like, this guy can't write a book at all. So I was devastated. That was my only link to the publishing world. you know, I had $1,000. I wasn't getting paid to live here. I'm writing a book, and you know, it just looks like an impossible feat now. So, you know, I kind of go into this depression that summer, and I just really begin to question my ideals and my values. Did I make the right decision? It's like I'm paying for all my idealistic sins, because eventually I was so broke I had to start working at this truck stop again. So I was kind of on this Scrooge-like tour of my past, revisiting just these menial jobs. Like, I become a tour guide again. And then the camp manager asks if I want to wash dishes, except this time it's going to be in Dead Horse, Alaska, which is probably the most miserable place on earth, right next to Prudhoe Bay, the oil fields. After that, I'm like, I'm going to get the hell out of Dead Horse and I'm going to start this book again. And I found some literary agents after that. I moved back to North Carolina, really focused on the book. We submitted my book proposal to 17 publishers and we got an offer, and everything's been good since then. Go forward and
reverse. Author Ken Ilgunas. He spoke with Bethany Chafin here at the WFDD studios. To read more about Ken's adventures, you can visit his blog. You'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And if you can relate to Ken's story and have one or two of your own to tell, find us on Facebook. How did you manage to stay out of debt while in college? We'd love to hear from you. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Michaela Nance. You'll find podcasts and archive programs at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.